ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
G'day there. Welcome to AM. It's Monday, the 18th of March. I'm David Lipson, coming to you from Ngunnawal country, Canberra. Russian President Vladimir Putin has won a fifth term with 88% of the vote, according to the first official exit poll results in the country's presidential contest. The result is no surprise. His main rivals are either dead, behind bars, or disqualified from running. There have been protests, though, and dozens of incidents of vandalism at polling stations. As Europe correspondent Steve Kinnane reports from Vilnius in Lithuania, human rights groups say at least 80 people have been detained.
I'm standing at the back of the Russian embassy in Vilnius, where a polling station has been set up for the presidential election. And there's this long, snaking queue of over 300 people here. And that's because Alexei Navalny, last month before he died in prison, called on Russian voters to turn up en masse at polling stations at midday on Sunday. In a country where protest has been criminalised and no real opposition candidates are even allowed on the ballot, it's one of the few ways voters can safely show they're opposed to President Putin and his war in Ukraine. One of the people here is Maria Pevchik, chair of Navalny's Anti-Corruption Foundation.
Well, it's very nice to see all of these people who came here today in solidarity with Navalny, with our movement in general. And it's, of course, it's always good to have proof that like-minded people exist, but of course the main thing today is happening inside Russia on those polling stations in Moscow, in St. Petersburg, in Kazan, in any big or small city. This is where the main heroes are.
In Moscow, St. Petersburg and other cities, big queues did form at polling stations at midday. The Central Election Commission's head, Ella Panfilova, claimed the big queues at noon were simply the result of Russians who were outraged at green dye attacks on ballot boxes on the first 2 days of the election, a comment that was not backed up by those in the queues. I support the campaign announced for midday today, said one voter. I voted for a protest candidate, said another. Last month, anti-war politician Boris Nadezhdin told AM he did not believe presidential elections in Russia were free or fair. Today, he took the brave step of admitting he did not vote for Putin. I believe that the Russian people today have a chance to show their real attitude to what is happening by voting not for Putin, but for some other candidates or in some other way, which is exactly what I did. In Berlin, Alexei Navalny's wife Yulia joined large queues at the Noon Against Putin protests. Whatever the true results are in this election, a large proportion of the population in Russia continues to support President Putin. But for Maria Pevchik and others who worked closely with Navalny, giving up on democratic reform in their country is not an option.
I've never lost hope, despite the fact that we're going through the darkest times, all of this. People are living through a massive tragedy, massive loss. I'm referring to Alexei Navalny's death. One of the last words that Alexei has written from prison was that the hope still exists. So I have absolutely no reason to question that.
That's Maria Pevchik, the chair of Alexei Navalny's Anti-Corruption Foundation. She was speaking with Europe correspondent Steve Kinnane in Vilnius. Several Palestinians whose visas were cancelled while they were trying to make their way to Australia have now had their documents reissued. Last week, the Home Affairs Department cancelled more than 10 visitor visas, but now additional security and other checks have been carried out, and that's resulted in some people having their visas reapproved. The decision came soon after the federal government restored aid funding to the UN's main relief organisation in Gaza. Funding was stopped after several UNRWA workers were found to have taken part in the October 7 terrorist attacks on Israel. But Foreign Minister Penny Wong says the best available advice is it's not a terrorist organisation. As John Daly reports, it's had mixed response from Australia's Jewish and Arab communities.
It's sunset at a mosque in Perth. Khaled Garia is one of those praying for more humanitarian aid to be let into Gaza.
We are very hurt, you know, very hurt to see our brothers and sisters dying, especially when aid is brought to them. The people that are delivering that aid are getting bombed, you know, so this is something that's despicable.
The government will resume $6 million of funding for the UN's primary aid agency operating inside Gaza, UNRWA. It's welcome news for Khaled Gurria.
Of course, any aid that we can get to our brothers and sisters that are just being treated like animals, of course, this would be amazing.
Aid was frozen to UNRWA when Israel made serious allegations of links between aid workers and the terrorist organisation responsible for the October 7th attacks, Hamas. Mohammed Shakib is a Perth-based imam.
What the Australian government should do is make their decisions based on morality instead of just blindly following their allies.
Canada and the European Union will also resume funding to UNRWA, but the US won't. Imam Shakib says the thaw of aid funding is encouraging, but he worries it's perhaps not enough.
I guess it may be a case of better late than never, as opposed to hopefully not too little too late.
The October 7 terror attacks and subsequent war in Gaza has opened up deep rifts even in Australia, and the issues of UNRWA funding is another example of a contentious issue dividing communities. The Jewish community has condemned the government's move to restore funding to UNRWA. Steve Liblick from the Jewish Community Council of WA is upset the government didn't wait for results from investigations into the group's alleged terrorist links.
It hasn't waited to the end of those. It's just simply turning the tap back on and sending Australian taxpayer dollars to UNRWA, which is most likely going to aid Hamas's war efforts.
Steve Liblick says the government has bowed to political pressure and worries it will stoke up what he sees as growing anti-Semitism in Australia.
I know that there is significant anxiety. I myself feel significant anxiety about the open expression of anti-Semitism.
Steve Liblick says it's at a point where some community members are now too anxious to wear religious symbols in public.
And particularly on campus, the students are feeling that very much.
The opposition wants the government to hold off on its decision until alleged terrorist ties are fully investigated.
John Daly there. The security situation in Haiti continues to deteriorate. Americans stuck in the Caribbean nation are now being encouraged to sign up for an emergency government chartered flight out of there. Gangs have seized control of much of the capital, Port-au-Prince, looting, kidnapping and attacking homes and police stations. North America correspondent Barbara Miller reports.
Haitians are all too used to violence, but the situation has now reached rock bottom. We've no idea where to go, this woman says, throwing her hands in the air. She's one of many Haitians who've seen their homes looted and destroyed by marauding gangs.
They burning and they killing.
On a chaotic video call with the ABC, Yusuf Alomari translated for a man whose home and car have been set alight by the gangs.
He lost everything he was working hard to build.
Residents have been left without shelter or access to clean water and food, with gangs now estimated to be in control of 80% of the capital. Haiti is now effectively leaderless. From outside the country, Prime Minister Ariel Henry announced last week he would resign once a transitional council was set up. On ABC America's This Week, White House National Security spokesman John Kirby praised the initiative.
Haitian-led Haitian groups came together and decided on this transitional presidential council to appoint an interim prime minister. It looks like that process is moving forward, so that's a good thing.
But no one consulted the gangs about the new arrangements, including the man known as Barbecue, former elite police officer Jimmy Cherizier. Robert Faton is a Haitian-American and professor of government and foreign affairs at the University of Virginia.
The gangs have autonomy. And what is more alarming is that at one point there was warfare between the different gangs. And for the last 10 days, the gangs have federated, they've united. And that means that you have a much more powerful military force.
The U.S. government is backing a multinational security mission led by Kenya to try and restore order. But Kenya has paused the initiative and further U.S. funding for it hasn't been approved by the Republican-led House. Michael McCaul, chairman of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, spoke to Fox News Sunday.
We have a history in this country of throwing weapons and guns into countries and they backfire.
The US hasn't said when its charter flight will leave, but it won't go from Port-au-Prince, but from Cap Haïtien, a couple of hundred kilometres north of the capital. The State Department is cautioning that the overland journey is dangerous and the security situation unpredictable.
That report by Barbara Miller in Washington with Phoebe Hosier and Brad Ryan. Energy users have been hanging out for some relief in electricity prices ever since the big falls in the spot price following the record highs of 2022. But with energy regulators poised to reveal draft changes to benchmark power prices from July, market observers are warning bills may not fall much and may even increase slightly. National Energy reporter Daniel Mercer has the story.
Craig Souter likes to keep a close eye on his power costs. The single father pays the mortgage and all the bills for his house in Shoalhaven on the south coast of New South Wales, meaning every dollar has to count.
You're always on the lookout for the best deal. I always compare. I'm not loyal. I'm happy to change.
It was a shock to the 59-year-old, therefore, when his power bill went from $600 to $1,430, leaving him with an acute case of bill shock. He says the dramatic increase in his power costs came after his provider Origin installed a smart meter at his house.
It's a hit, you know, because I earn okay money, but I'd be only earning as much as everybody else. I pay my own mortgage on my own. I pay all my own bills here, like electricity, insurance, everything. This is my place and I'm paying. So it's a killer.
A spokesman for Origin said Craig Souter's bill had increased because of increased usage, the underestimation of a previous invoice, and a new, more expensive plan. But his experience is not uncommon in an electricity market where prices have soared since the energy crisis 2 years ago. The increases have helped drive a big rise in benchmark prices set by the Australian Energy Regulator and its Victorian counterpart. Known as default market offers, the prices are effectively a maximum rate retailers can charge their customers. After rocketing about 40% in the past 2 years, there had been hopes that recent falls in the spot market could deliver consumers some relief. But with the regulators set to release draft decisions for changes that will come into effect from July, experts aren't so sure.
I would say that we're going to be plus or minus a few percent here in terms of the pricing. This is despite some rhetoric regarding lower prices in the spot market. I just don't see that passing through to the final calculation on the DMO.
Josh Stabler is the Managing Director of Energy Edge. He says while wholesale electricity costs have come down from their record highs, they remain elevated. At the same time, he says rising interest rates and inflation are pushing up the costs of poles and wires, which typically account for the biggest share of a power bill.
So the market conditions for the new financial year aren't substantially different.
On ABC Radio recently, AER Director Justin Oliver echoed the cautionary tone.
We're not expecting big increases, but we're not necessarily expecting big decreases either at this stage.
Shoalhaven householder Craig Souter, for one, isn't holding out much hope.
In 6 years' time, I'm looking to retire, so I'll have super and pension. If I'm going to be paying that sort of money, that's over $5,000 a year just in electricity. How do you survive? How does anyone survive?
That's Shoalhaven householder Craig Souter ending that report by Daniel Mercer. And a spokesperson for Origin Energy says Mr. Souter's bill has increased because of increased usage, the underestimation of a previous invoice, and a new, more expensive plan. One of the ways households can reduce their power bills is by installing solar panels or batteries, but some such items don't come cheap. Today, there's a renewed push for the federal government to provide additional support so that more renters and low-income households will be able to pay less to keep the lights on. Political reporter Stephanie Boris has more.
As politicians return to Canberra for another sitting week, the government's facing growing demands to do more to help households with rising bills.
It is time to show Australian families you can do the right thing for environment, but you can also do the right thing for your hip pocket.
Independent MP Allegra Spender says solar panels and batteries reduce emissions and bring power prices down.
People who have solar, save $1,100 to $1,800 permanently on their energy bills. Year in, year out.
But the setup costs means it's out of reach for many, while renters don't even have the option to install. Several crossbenchers, as well as 12 welfare, housing, climate and energy groups, are today urging the government to intervene. To help renters, they want the instant asset write-off offered to landlords so they can claim a deduction on energy-saving appliances installed. And for low-income households, rebates of up to 30% on items that help to electrify the home. Among the groups backing the change is National Shelter CEO Emma Greenholsch. She's warning serious change is needed, otherwise...
What we end up with is a two sort of tiered housing system. I mean, that's defined by those who are able to access, you know, energy efficient appliances and have batteries and solar, to those households who really might be living in housing that is really unhealthy.
Under the plan, 500,000 households would become more power efficient over 3 years at a cost of $500 million a year. Allegra Spender says that's money well spent.
I think this is absolutely a no-brainer for the government.
The federal government has spent millions of dollars working with the states and territories on different energy programs, which include funding solar on rental properties and apartment blocks. Emma Greenholsch says it's a good start but doesn't go far enough.
It's really then about ramping up that scale of investment, you know, to be able to have this infrastructure be much more widely available.
Treasurer Jim Chalmers has indicated there could be further cost of living support in the upcoming May budget, but has played down the prospect of it being too significant. While the crossbench doesn't have the power to force government to install policy, Allegra Spender says starting the conversation is half the battle.
My job is to make them listen, and that's why we've got over 12 community groups who've come together saying this is right for those communities who are missing out, but it is also right for the environment.
That's Independent MP Allegra Spender ending that report by Stephanie Boris. There's been an unprecedented surge in the number of times police in New South Wales have used their stop and search powers. 3.7 million searches have been conducted in the past 20 years, a six-fold increase. And 9 out of 10 times, nothing illegal's been found. Legal experts are concerned that indicates that the majority of person searches conducted by New South Wales Police over recent years may have been unlawful. The revelations come as a coronial inquest into the police shooting of a young Sydney man resumes later today, which has been examining the use of search powers by New South Wales Police. Paul Farrell reports.
Four plainclothes police officers jumped out of an unmarked car and approached 20-year-old Brad Bowson on the streets of St Mary's in Western Sydney. It was a warm December day and Brad had been out having a morning cigarette round the corner from his house. The encounter was caught on CCTV. Brad wasn't in possession of drugs and hadn't committed any offences. His mother, Belinda Collins, says police should have left him alone.
Brad had every right to be able to keep walking and they should have just let him keep going.
After one of the officers grabbed him, Brad turns and runs, back to his own house. There's no CCTV of what happens next. But moments later, inside the house, his dad, Adam, heard gunshots ring out.
I woke up to the burstary, went outside.
He saw two police officers and a lifeless body on the ground. Nearly an hour later, he gets the terrible news.
I was sitting in the front yard and an officer went out and took a picture of him and showed me on his phone.
A coronial inquest has been investigating what happened that day. It's heard evidence police officers were suspicious of Brad Bowson because he was wearing a black hoodie on a warm morning in a known crime hotspot. Brad's uncle, Troy Bowson, doesn't accept this reasoning.
Whenever I see someone with a hoodie, it just brings me back to Brad. Something similar could happen to them.
The officers who stopped Brad were part of a specialist unit called a proactive crime team. And it's the job of these units to interact with the community to deter criminals before they act. And they were set targets to achieve this goal. And this means conducting more stop and searches on people. Lee McGibbon is a former member of a proactive crime team based in King's Cross.
I had real doubts about the efficacy of what we were doing.
New data obtained by the ABC under FOI shows that in around 90% of person searches, no illicit objects were found by New South Wales Police. Associate Professor in Law Vicky Sentis from UNSW says that should raise alarm bells.
Because find rate, something being found, it's kind of a reliable proxy for did the police exercise their search powers reasonably. It's likely that the vast majority of searches in this state are conducted unlawfully.
The New South Wales Police told Background Briefing that proactive strategies have a direct correlation to crime reduction and there are multiple ways to measure officers' performance. A police spokesman declined to comment on the Balzan case while the inquest is ongoing. Adam Balzan has now brought a civil claim against the state of New South Wales. Here's his lawyer, Peter O'Brien.
The case that we are litigating is the worst possible outcome imaginable of proactive policing going wrong.
That's lawyer Peter O'Brien ending that report by Paul Farrell. The full report can be found on Background Briefing. That's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm David Lipson.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. You can barely buy anything with it, but the price of Bitcoin has hit an all-time high. So how has the cryptocurrency many people wrote off just a few years back bounced back? Today, Andrew Chow, technology correspondent at Time magazine, on the Bitcoin boom. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.